Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Midrats. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And a reminder to those who are joining us live, if you wanted to scroll down to the bottom of the show page, the chat room is there with the usual suspects. Maggie, glad to see you back early. You usually show up late, so you're not on Maggie Standard Time today. That's always a plus. If you have some observations, or if you just want to make fun of people from Boston, feel free to roll into the show page. Eagle One and I will be there, and we'll make sure and try to take those questions and fold them in as we go along. And if you have to leave partway through the show, or you want to catch up on some previous episodes, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, as I'm trying to get the iTunes people to fix the iTunes feed, but that's my project for next week. But hey, enough of my IT problems. Let's get on with the show. There's been a fair bit of talk about the Arctic and economic and also from a strategic perspective over the last few years. And when you look at where international interests lie, whether it's national security or whether it's looking for resources, the Arctic continues to draw people. And it's more than just the Alaskan pipeline. It's all the nations involved up there. And when you look at security, patrolling, the natural thought, at least for this crowd, may be the Navy, but there's another maritime service out there that actually has some history in the Arctic and also has some ability and some capacity to be a player there. And the question is the Coast Guard the right answer to the question of how we best support secure and presence needs in the Arctic? And as our guest for the entire hour today, and we're using as a kind of a stepping out point. If you go over to the show page, you'll find a link to his article over in Foreign Policy titled America Needs a Coast Guard That Can Fight. Our guest for the full hour will be Naval War College Professor James R. Holm, Ph.D. Jim, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Oh, it's definitely good to have you back on. And I just wanted to kind of use as a scene setter for those that may not have had a chance to read the article is – especially in the last year, there's been a lot of talk about the Pacific pivot. But before then and interspaced in there, the Arctic keeps coming up, whether it's talking about the potential down the road for additional maritime paths and with less ice coverage coming up there, not to mention the resources that are available there. And you've looked at the problem and you've looked at some of our national assets, and you see that a good fix might not be the Navy, might not be the Marine Corps, might actually be the U.S. Coast Guard. If you could outline that for us, what makes the Coast Guard perhaps the right fit to meet our national security needs up north?
Well, I got interested in this topic, partly because I got interested in the nature of the theater itself. As you know, I've made a study out of my hands works, and in particular his more geopolitically minded works over the past 10 years or so, I guess. I've always been really taken with what Mahan said about the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico when he was looking at the strategic features of those regions and made the case for the importance to the United States. So having looked at that, I applied that logic to the South China Sea, which bears a lot of resemblance. And then I got the idea that it looks like we have an emerging new theater to the north, except that it's going to be kind of a strange theater. And this is the case that I lay out in the foreign policy piece, is that it's kind of an odd theater, because if the ice advances and retreats every year, that means the shape of the theater is going to essentially change over the month, plus or minus a little bit, that Admiral Titley, our former chief oceanographer, estimates it might be open for They essentially might be ice-free for an entire month each year. So I get to, got interested in that from a theoretical standpoint. But if you, it looks to me, well, I mean, there's really two things as far as the Navy going. I think the Navy simply does not have the assets to spare from another entire theater. I think we're already sort of scattered all over the globe, and it's very hard to see the Navy taking on another secondary theater, especially given the imperative to concentrate in East and South Asia. So that's point one. Point two, with regard to the Coast Guard, it appears just because it'll be a theater that's only temporarily open each year, it looks like it would be. I mean, I have a hard time envisioning any really serious high-end conflict happening up there. So the Coast Guard, as long as it relearns its combat traditions, I guess it would, perhaps be ready to take on any challenges that might come up there, using the Navy and the Marines as a backstop if something really unforeseen happens. And I guess the other point with the Coast Guard is simply that it has the experience operating to the north, and the Navy really does not, except with the exception of the submarine force, as you know. So. I guess that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of what I see over at Foreign Policy.
Well, NORTHCOM, or Northern Command, would normally have, jurisdiction over the 1,000-plus miles of the Arctic coastline. Are you suggesting any change from that, or is it going to be, do you see just strengthening the Coast Guard for a special mission up there in conjunction with the Canadians, or how do you envision this all working?
And that's a good question. I mean, that's kind of where I would like to take this next. I haven't really gotten to it. You know, I'd like to take the discussion there next when I continue writing about this stuff. I mean, it is kind of an interesting theater because, we are at odds with the Canadians a little bit over the nature of the passages up there, and so forth. It almost feels like a throwback to the Alaskan border controversy a century ago, which I think was the last time we had any sort of territorial issues with the Canadians. But yeah, I could certainly see some sort of collaboration. It kind of, interestingly, the five Arctic powers, four of them are NATO powers, which I think is an advantage for the United States as well. But yeah, from a coalition standpoint, I could see something, some sort of entente happening up there to the north.
In the second paragraph of your article over at Foreign Policy, you put in just to quote you there. You said, "The Coast Guard's aging fleet of cutters and small craft would be critical to upholding maritime security and hedging against maritime conflict." And you know, the opening part of that, we all have our visions of what our cutters and small craft look like. When we look up north to Alaska, you know, what is the Air Force doing in Alaska to enhance security? They got their F-22 up there, their latest. We also have the ground-based missile center interceptors up north. But I really don't see where the Navy or the Coast Guard or the Maritime Services are really looking at investing in new equipment and new technology. Is this another case of the unsexy but important getting lost because there's no advocacy? And I think, you know, Eagle One mentioned NORTHCOM. You think that would be the natural source of somebody to pound a drum for initial assets. Who is a uniformed advocate, if there is such a creature, who is writing about, from a maritime perspective, what type of resources, capabilities we may need to have up there in order to enhance security?
Well, I think you hit on it. Actually, I think the opening of the Arctic is, well, I mean, it's an uncertain thing anyway, and if things unfold as many climate scientists predict, we're still looking at several decades down the road. So I think you answered your own question when you asked whether there's a constituency for it. I don't really see a whole lot of constituents out there for preparedness up to the north, just because I don't want to say the threat, all the challenges that we might see to the north remain rather remote and abstract and theoretical at this point. Which makes it kind of a hard sell to invest very, very scarce funds in new capabilities for something that won't happen for some time now.
Let me do a little bit of follow up here. I'm going to be a little bit snarky here at our vision or lack of it. And within living memory, we had icebreakers that were armed with 5-inch guns, anti-aircraft equipment. We had a fair bit of teeth on things that went up north, but it just seems to slowly be drifting away. I wonder if part of that has to do with the institutional memory from the Coast Guard's heavy involvement in combat operations in World War II, played a little bit around in Riverine during Vietnam, but decades under the Department of Transportation, has that just been a cost savings line to the point that not only were you not focused on being able to be forward in a very important part of the world like our, you know, a lot of our allies in Russia have, but what we do send up there really can't even defend itself from a bunch of people in a Zodiac.
Yeah, I did a little snooping around, and the last time I could find of the last instance, I should say, of that I can find of the Coast Guard doing something that looked like a traditional naval mission was in Vietnam. With the it appeared that there was a couple of cutters over there and did some naval gunfire support off the Vietnamese coast, which was kind of surprising to me. I didn't actually realize that. But yeah, I think this. Well, I mean, yes, I think there's some generational change that has gone on. You talked about the loss of institutional memory. I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is simply I would say the Navy and the other sea services declared an end to history in the early 1990s after the Cold War. Kind of interesting that we had the famous end of history thesis from Frank Fukuyama. I believe that was the same year that the Navy published From the Sea, in which it essentially declared that the Navy faced no challenge to command of the sea, and thus it could go and focus primarily on power projection. So there's a combination of things, as you say, the loss of institutional memory, and also a deliberate decision to de-emphasize the sorts of capabilities that you're talking about. I think the Coast Guard was swept up in that as well, with the disarming of cutters and in that same time frame. It's just a tradition of sea control that we need to rediscover.
Yeah, you reminded me of I had a skipper who had been on a destroyer, and he'd been a sea of a little minesweep off Vietnam during the market time operation, and got in a gunfight with a trawler of some sort, and fortunate for him, a Coast Guard cutter popped up over the horizon and helped to blow away the trawler, so that otherwise his minesweep would have been even more shredded than it turned out to be.
That's cool.
Do you envision an increase in the size of the Coast Guard to cover this greater territory that may global warming or whatever it is may cause to be there?
I have a hard time seeing how you could do it with the current. I mean, it's just as with the Navy, it's if the Navy was going to cover an entirely new theater, I think you'd have to expand the size of the Navy or move back towards an older tradition, in which we used to have one unified fleet and had to think about which coast to put it on. I don't think the Coast Guard really has that luxury though, because they simply have the waters and the airspace that they have to cover. So I think it would be a hard thing to get around. The other aspect of it is if we do expect the Coast Guard to be the lead service and to have at least some low-level combat role there, I think you would certainly need to arm your cutters and perhaps develop new classes that look a little bit more like warships than some of the cutters do today. So yeah, I think that would certainly be how I would see things unfolding.
You're talking about combat operations in the Arctic. We still do exercises up there, ISECs, and there's a few other ones. But when you mentioned earlier about occasionally Canada gets a little uppity and they like to throw around their submarines, one of the major reasons they have submarines is because of the unique capability of being able to get around under the ice that submarines give us. So if there was a potential some type of conflict up there, not necessarily against Canada, but there would be a requirement for anti-submarine warfare. And I think that's one of the chinks in the armor of if we committed the Coast Guard up north. I remember back when I was an ensign, the U.S. Coast Guard still had their Mark 32 over-the-side torpedoes They still practice ASW, but they got, again, with the end of history that actually was just a new chapter of history, which anybody could tell you but Fukuyama at the time, the Coast Guard threw that away. Is there any type of appetite or appreciation of the fact that that might not have been a wise move? And I don't even know if there's a bolt-on capability with their latest cutters that they're building, that they, even if they wanted to have an ASW capability, that they would be able to do that.
Yeah, my impression is that they don't have such a capability. I just think that they've, as they've tried to recapitalize the force, they had to let what looked like secondary capabilities go. I mean, that's with From the Sea and the other directives that came down, that was a very strong bureaucratic signal that that you just don't need to do this stuff that much anymore.
Yeah, you don't need it until you got a high speed torp heading your way, then you make
Eagle One.
Yeah, do you? As I understand it, the two big icebreakers we currently have are both in the yard being fixed up so they can serve for another zillion years, and the only one that we currently have that's really operational is a smaller one, the Healy, I think it is. Are we going to need to revisit the number of icebreakers and that sort of thing, or is there a way to buy commercial stuff that'll work for this?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I know. I'm not sure I know a good answer to that one. Not being an Arctic person myself, but I think that as far as the need, I could certainly see the need arising. That's, again, if you look at how the theater will probably, I mean, it's almost a cyclical thing each year. I would say on either end of that warm period in which the Arctic becomes ice free, you'll need brave icebreakers to get up there and help you get around in the region. It's kind of an interesting dynamic. I would imagine that the shape of the theater as the ice advances and goes back, it will actually change where the sea lanes are located, not only from not only within each year but also from year to year. So I would certainly see a need for more icebreakers. Clearly the Russians and our other Arctic neighbors see that need as well.
Last week on the show, we had Dr. Joan Johnson-Freeze on, and one of the things that we talked about is up there at the Naval War College is taking mid-career officers and getting them to think hard and think deep and to publish and not to be afraid to draw outside the lifelines and question orthodoxy, how challenging that can be. And I know that we have some great Coast Guard officers that y'all see up at the Naval War College as well. Have you seen any appetite amongst them to go beyond the standard issue disaster response and environmental enforcement areas that you read a lot about Coast Guard people talking about, or counter-narcotics, and to talk a little bit more about the toothy bits that you've been bringing up? Is there an appetite to engage in that conversation, or is it, again, a dead topic that's just going to need to be kicked a few times before it gets up and running again inside the Coast Guard Officer Corps?
Well, I just finished reading her book. I went down and I heard part of the program last week, and I went down and pulled out the copy and read her book, which is very good. I actually don't know any Coast Guard people at the college right now. We don't have any Coast Guard officers in our department right now, and it's been a while since I've had a Coast Guard student. But certainly you don't hear them talking. Being such a small service and so forth, you don't get a Coastie every year. My impression from the ones that I've had in the past is that they're very much in the law enforcement disaster response. All of the things that they do on a day to day basis. You mentioned a while ago, and I meant to say something about the bureaucratic culture. We have to remember that the Coast Guard belonging to first to the Transportation Department and now to Homeland Security. That's a very strange organizational environment for a war fighting service. And you have to suspect that they just it seems a little bit foreign to them at this point. Being a law enforcement, one point I made in the article for people who don't study this stuff is that It's not all about the domain where you operate. The Navy and the Coast Guard cultures are very different, and that's simply because they're more law enforcement and a law enforcement service. For a law enforcement service, the enemy is quite different from that from a military service, and that I actually feel like it's quite a different culture that you study when you look at the Coast Guard as opposed to the Navy or the Marines.
You've written a couple of pieces for The Diplomat in which you declared at some point, I thought, or questioned whether or not the surface fleets are done. Is this new view up of what's going on in the Arctic? Does that change your view on that?
That's actually a good question. Let me put it to you this way. It's kind of an interesting theater in another sense for the United States, simply because it's right off our shores. We're used to playing away games, as you point out, and we might be able to turn the logic of anti-access towards our own advantage up to the north. For example, with using the Coast Guard, using Air Force aircraft, and so on and so forth, to essentially mount an anti-access or sea denial environment up there to the north. So I guess in a sense, yeah, I have to think about that one a little bit more. With submarines, yeah, that's a great question. We gotta play with this a little bit more. Certainly, if the Coast Guard is going to be the standard bearer for us up north, that's obviously there's utility for a surface fleet there as well. But in any event, the bottom line right now for me is that we might ought to consult not just Mahan and the other high end sea power theorists, but also perhaps even the Je ne Cole, the continental theories of sea power when thinking through these questions. Because that's quite a different approach to sea power than what we're used to.
It's always fun to. I want to kind of put you on the spot here, but that's okay. You're a professor; you can handle it. I always like to take people, and I think you kind of do it here as well. I like to take people's words and pummel them with it. And you mentioned in your article that U.S. Coast Guard publication 3TAC-0 operations, quote, instructs the service to prepare itself for coastal sea control operations in which cutters patrol off enemy shores as an adjunct to U.S. naval operations, unquote. Can you really do that with a bunch of ships that have nothing but 76 and 57 millimeter main guns and a small, tiny helo? I mean, are they just saying that because it sounds good, or is there institutional delusion, or is this just what we would like to have? Because really, those words do not match what the capability of the Coast Guard is.
Yeah, in fact, I wasn't surprised to see that in those documents when I read up on the strategic directive. But because that's obviously part of the Coast Guard's tradition and part of its culture. If you look at the Coast Guard commandant's website and so forth, they're always pointing out that we are a military service. We do have a combat tradition and so on and so forth. But yeah, it does not appear like the force structure actually lines up with the actual documentation. What is coastal sea control? It's rather ill defined, and it doesn't feel like the force structure really matches up with the requirement. As you know, it's easy to put something in a directive, but sometimes you don't actually put that into practice in real life. It all depends on what the leadership makes a priority and directs resources and so forth towards.
We're having a little fun in the chat room, but how serious are the Chinese about their claims to some rights in the Arctic that we, I'm not sure how they decided they have that right or interest?
But the Chinese in the Arctic, you mean?
Yeah, in the Arctic.
Yeah, the best I know, the Chinese are they're essentially it's kind of interesting when you look at their claims in their own seas near China, and compare that to the Arctic. I believe the last I heard was that the Chinese were claiming that was an international water space and that it shouldn't be subject to exclusive economic zones and all the other things that you see in other seas around the world. There's another interesting point with regard to China. As long as we're talking about coast guards, which is simply that China, it appears, has created its own Coast Guard, unifying a lot of the different maritime services that that we've seen at work in the South China Sea and the East China Sea into one unified agency. With response, there was a lot of thought that there was disunity of effort and so forth at Scarborough Shoal and off the Senkakus and other places. So it's kind of, as we start to think about Coast Guards, it's kind of interesting to see the Chinese also thinking about that arm of sea power. But yes, as far as being serious, who knows? They unfortunately don't tell me such things. But do they have it? I guess one of the real questions is, would they have the physical capacity to back up such a claim up in the Arctic? Doesn't look like it right now, but something to watch down the road.
Speaking of Arctic nations, you mentioned them before. Of course, we have Norway, Denmark, Canada, the USA, and Russia. And they all have, I guess you could even roll the UK into there a little bit because they like to go play up north. But
sure.
They all kind of look at the Arctic slightly differently. You know, we've been looking at it from a U.S. perspective, kind of from the taking it Russian serious to taking it to the American, yeah, we'll get around to it, we get to it type of seriousness. How do those other nations look at the Arctic, and do they see it in a different way that we do that might help inform us as we think about it as well?
I actually think they do look at it differently, and probably the polar, to coin a phrase, probably the polar example of that would be Russia, simply because of Russian history has really kept Russian sea power confined. That's if you ever study Russian history, one of the main things you always learn is that they were always looking for a warm water port that wasn't iced in year round. Now. One thing that I didn't bring out in the article that we're discussing today, but I often do when I'm talking about the Arctic, is just to point this out. There was a great debate about a century ago between people like Mahan, sea power theorists, and between land power theorists like Sir Halford Mackinder, the great architect of the Heartland theory, the power that owned the Heartland could radiate power out from Central Asia, basically from the landmass of the former Soviet Union, and thus dominate Eurasia and thereby the world. But there was a lot of pushback during the Second World War from people like Nicholas Spikeman down at Yale, who was a great theorist. He was the great theorist of the Rimlands. He thought that the power that could operate around the periphery of Eurasia from the sea had the advantage over the land power that occupied the Heartland. But of course, that there was never a northern Rimland that was open to navigation, which would be along the northern Russian frontier. So this is really a game changer in Russian history, and I think that helps explain why the Russians have paid such keen interest to the Arctic, for example, by pulling stunts like going up and planting their flag on the seafloor and so on and so forth. So certainly the Russians attach a lot more value to the object, the political objects that they have, that they see in those waters to the north, simply because of that historical aspect. And I think that would apply to the other Arctic powers to a lesser extent, but certainly to Russia.
I guess that kind of gets into the question as far as Russia goes. I mean, we've got a fairly narrow strait going up into the Arctic Ocean that we share with Russia. Are we more likely to cooperate with them, you think, or is this going to be one of those things as we go down the road? It's just time will tell what's going to happen as far as working with them.
Yeah, I think that's the $64,000 question. As you point out, we certainly face off face them across the Bering Strait, and yeah, that will obviously become a key choke point not only for ourselves and the Russians, but also for countries like Japan, which is applied to the Arctic Council as an observer. Clearly, the Japanese are going to be looking to the north as well. So there's going to be a lot of northward axis to China and Japan's views of the world. As far as how things are going to shape up with the Russians, I think that's a great question, and I'm not sure. The Russians still have great grand aspirations. they still want to make themselves a relevant and a naval power and so on and so forth. So I think there will always be a certain amount of tension between ourselves and the Russians as long as they have those aspirations. And obviously we remain determined to be number one. So there's going to be a certain amount of friction. But I can't really think of anything that would bring us to blows off the top of my head.
Obviously, the economics of the commons of the sea are always a driver. And one of the big changes in the last 5 years ashore has been the success of fracking for the access to natural gas, to access to crude oil as well that wasn't reachable before. There's actually potential for a huge shift, especially around Poland and Germany. If they can have a similar success that we have had, they'll be less reliant on Russia oil. And a lot of the look at the Arctic a half decade ago looked at potential conflicts around economics. There are a few territorial disputes. Obviously, Russia wants to argue with everybody about borders. That's just Russian nature. Canada and Denmark have a little bit of a problem with an island, and that's all defining the seabed access. But as the success of fracking expands, and really the argument is about law and how the law will enable different nations to access those resources, do we have the potential here to, from at least the more dangerous potential scenarios, to have bought a few decades because of the technology of fracking is made the economics of getting more things out of the Arctic less attractive from a profits point of view? So what we're really looking at isn't so much access to resource, but managing sea lines of communication when the ice is open. So does that lead us to something that maybe it's not as requiring tooth and claw, but really does require a good presence and to give time for the diplomats and the lawyers to figure things out?
So the question basically should we be more focused on freedom of navigation or on the economic uses of the sea? Was that basically what?
Right, because I know a lot of the arguments had to do with access to hydrocarbons under the water, which is now with the advent of fracking ashore, isn't as big of an item, but because of the access to sea lines of communication with less ice coverage, the importance of the Arctic is still there, just maybe in a different flavor.
Yeah. I mean, my reflex is to focus, you know, to sort of be Mahan or Corbett, and then focus on the sea lines of communication and freedom of navigation and all those sorts of things. I think we have a pre-existing legal framework as far as partitioning up maritime territory to the north. Namely, the law of the sea. As many people have pointed out, the United States is not a party to the law of the sea treaty as such, but nonetheless, it basically complies with the law of the sea as it's written in that document. So there's certainly a basis for making all that happen. And as you point out, if these new hydrocarbon technologies, if they play out, it appears they are playing out. That's going to keep down the price, and thus the financial incentive to go out and invest in very, very expensive things like mining in the seafloor and so on and so forth. So yeah, I tend to think of it more in traditional sea power terms as far as guaranteeing the sea lines of communication and so forth. That's another one of the quirky things about the Arctic, though, is simply that the sea lines are not going to be. It doesn't appear that there would be, apart from the routes that immediately adjoin the Canadian and the Russian coast. It appears that the sea lines of communication are going to be fluid, so to speak, and moving, and it's just going to have the theater is simply going to have a different character from what we're used to.
Yeah, that does raise the question of, I mean, Canada's claims, a lot of Canada's claims are based on islands that they own fairly far into the Arctic Sea, and whereas the U.S. doesn't have that, it has its normal coastline. And Russians' claims are on this, I think it's the Leitmotiv shelf or something, it's part of the continental shelf. They're claiming that under UNCLOS that gives them sovereignty over a big chunk of the Arctic. Do you see them increasing their Arctic fleet at all?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty safe bet that if Well, I mean, and this almost relates back to Sal's last question about the prices of oil and so forth. As always, the Russians are heavily dependent on on that sort of natural resources for their national prosperity. So there's a tie-in there. There's one tie-in there, but consistent with their means, I could certainly see them increasing their Arctic fleet for the reason, and not only for the economics, but also for the geopolitical reasons that I mentioned before. I mean, keep in mind that having that, if the Arctic's open, that's not only does that open up the Russian North Coast for part of the year, it also lets the Russians combine the Eastern and Western fleets much easier than they have been in the past. I mean, if one of the historical examples that I often trot out when I discuss Russia is simply back to the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 1905, when the fleet was fragmented into three seas, one of which was totally unavailable because of the Turks would not let the Black Sea fleet out, and so the fleet was essentially divided into a Far East fleet at Port Arthur and Vladivostok and a Baltic fleet all the way to the west. So the Russians lost the Far East fleet. The Baltic fleet had to steam 20,000 miles all the way around through the Indian Ocean to get there. This is the kind of challenge that opening up of the Arctic will ease for the Russians. And I certainly would take advantage of it if I were them. And so I would expect to see that.
And something sure to wake all the 13XXs up out there. Over at the Diplomat, you also had an article that came up, which really interesting, because when I was thinking about the Coast Guard and the Arctic, when I saw this, I kind of laughed. I was like, yeah, that's an interesting take on it. You called it America's Odd Couple at Sea. That had to do with the Coast Guard and the Air Force just going right around the Navy Air, who's used to working with the Coast Guard because of maritime service. But when you're thinking about the Air Force and the Coast Guard cooperation, how much do they do now, and what advantages for the Coast Guard do you see where they have working closer with the Air Force that they wouldn't be able to do with Navy Air?
Yeah, I'm fortunate, as you point out, I'm fortunate to have a few places that let me think out loud, and this was one of the articles where I was just sort of thinking out loud. In fact, I just sort of jokingly called it a sort of an odd form of air-sea battle between bringing together these two very different services that don't work a lot together. I mean, as you know, the Air Force is always looking at the away game and not so much thinking about doing things like protecting seas adjacent to American coasts. So I don't. Yeah, my sense is that the Air Force and the Coast Guard don't work together a lot, and they certainly don't work together on this sort of mission, simply because it will be a new mission somewhere down the road. So trying to get those services which are so different to work harmoniously together will be a real challenge if the U.S. decided that was the strategic option they wanted to exercise in the Arctic. Whether the Air Force and the Coast Guard can work, I mean, that's, again, I was just sort of thinking out loud, but it's kind of a nifty idea. Air-sea battle taking on an entirely different cast.
Well, let me throw one more thing to the mix here. I recently did a blog post on methane hydrates, which, for those who don't know, is methane trapped in sort of ice, usually at great depth, but the Arctic is full of this stuff. It's about a third of the methane hydrate under the sea is apparently in the Arctic. Is that just, you know, as we look at oil under the surface and all that stuff, is this just another possibility of a place where the various interest groups will collide over what to do with this methane hydrate, which has potential to help further global warming?
It sounds like you're the expert on this one. I've encountered that. I've read up on it just a little bit, but I don't really consider global warming in the sense of it to be one of my fortes. So I think I might have to punt on that one.
We challenged the expert.
I'm not going to hang it out there on that one just because that's a little bit outside my normal zone.
We'll give you a pass.
Yeah.
I'd like to indulge my curiosity here for a second, because in that same article, The Odd Couple at Sea. You mentioned a couple of geopolitical thinkers. You know, A.T. Mahan, got him. McKendler, a little less. But I kind of felt kind of sheepish because you mentioned a Nicholas Spikeman, if that's how you pronounce his name. If you would just take a minute, who is Nicholas Spikeman, and why should people be interested in reading what he has to say?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll just bridge back to what I was saying about the Rimlands and the Heartland a few minutes ago. Yeah, that was Spikeman who I was actually talking to. Who would McKendler? Of course, McKendler was of course the Heartland theorist. He was the land power guy. Spikeman was a professor at Yale back, and unfortunately, he died young. He died about our ages, unfortunately. Which is kind of sobering. Back in 1943 or thereabouts. But if anybody's interested in this stuff, his books, he did publish a couple of books that are just wonderful. One is called The Geography of the Peace, which is where he advances most of his geopolitical ideas. And he also did a closely related book called America's Strategy in World Politics, or something very close to that. I might have the end of the title there wrong, but certainly America's Strategy in International Politics or something along those lines. But yeah, he was a great proponent of sea power, its mobility, its ability to project power into Eurasia, which was mostly what he was concerned about. If you look at his maps are very beautiful in the Geography of the Peace. But one thing he does depict is U.S. forces and Allied forces operating the Eurasian Rimland during the Second World War. But of course, there wasn't anything going on to the north there. So this. I guess it would be interesting to have him back to revise that book, assuming the Arctic does open, because that would put a whole different sort of a north-south spin on his theories that just wasn't present back in the 1940s. But yeah, one of my favorite theorists for sure.
Well, let's get back to the Coast Guard for a second. Let me pick your brain on what you would envision. Maybe we've kind of touched on this already, but what would be the ideal configuration for the Coast Guard in the Arctic or in the Alaska area?
What would be the ideal configuration up in the area? Well, it's one of those things that's kind of hard to say. It's kind of hard to say this far out, just because we don't know exactly what the scope and pace of climate change is going to be.
I ask no easy questions.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's fine. I was just, I was just fending you off while I think. Well, I mean, this relates back to what we were discussing before. I certainly think you'd have to see the Coast Guard look at its own strategic documents and actually think hard about what that coastal sea control mission is. Scope out the probability that the Coast Guard might actually need to defend the American EEZ, or you know, just basically look at the strategic situation. Whenever I look at this stuff. I always fall back on Clausewitz and his ideas about net assessments. He starts at the very ethereal and then he works down and then he scoops down to the operational level. He says, well, if you want to size it, when you're sizing up a theater, you look at the strength of the situation of the potential antagonists. You look at the political aims that they have at stake. You look at the capacity of their people and their governments, and you think about third parties as well, potential adversaries or allies that might get pulled into a controversy. So if you take that, I think if you take that logic and apply it, if you apply it to the Arctic, and then try to apply it to the Coast Guard, I think you would certainly have to build some battle capacity into it, just as a deterrent to things going wrong in the Arctic. Now, so I would expect to see cutters that you know bring back some of that Cold War capability that we were familiar with when we were junior officers. So certainly I would expect to see some of that. Now I'll put a plug into a thesis that I was pushing last year with regard to the Chinese when they were using their maritime enforcement services, and indeed they still are today. I called it small stick diplomacy, and it was obviously a takeoff on Teddy Roosevelt's idea of big stick diplomacy. Namely, I said that it behooved the Chinese to use the Coast Guard. Because it's almost an uncontroversial service that polices waters that belong to a nation by right. Well, the United States, so you know, you don't send the Chinese wouldn't send the Navy in order to Scarborough Shoal or something like that, because that would be admitting that they had to fight for that. rather they would send out more of a law enforcement type service to police what rightfully belonged to China. So now, I think that when I look at the Arctic, I can almost see the United States deploying a variant of that as well, using the U.S. Coast Guard as the small stick off American shores and in the international waters in the Arctic, and then using the U.S. Navy as the backstop, sort of the over the horizon deterrent, should things go badly. So there is still a U.S. Navy component to this overall architecture. But as far as the Coast Guard does have to, it will need enough capability to essentially hold the line in a fight until naval forces can come on scene if need be. As far as specifics, I guess we'll see.
Earlier on in the show, over in the chat room, Jerry brought up something that's been sticking in my craw ever since. I wanted to roll this your way. A phrase is just anathema to me, but I'm always concerned when what I consider to be bad ideas start getting planted in a lot of very important brains. And he was having a conversation with a history professor over at Harvard who basically stated, and I'm paraphrasing here, correct me if I'm wrong, Jerry, that when it comes to maritime issues and maritime history, that history is settled, i.e. that what is to be known is known, and it's settled. I find that very disturbing because that always leads to complacency, bad assumptions becoming written and chiseled into stone. And history really never is settled. It's always changed. You know, we were laughing a little bit ago about, you know, Fukuyama's the end of the history. What a joke that was. But that does come up on a regular basis by very smart people who at that snapshot in time are justified in saying that. But you could have said that in 1848. You could have said that in 1769. You know, throughout history, there are times people think it's ended, but it hasn't. What are some things that really smart people who you think really would know better would say something to you like history is settled about maritime issues? What's a couple of things that are happening right now that you might want to throw at them to have them think about what they said and whether that's really the best thing for them to say?
I'm not even sure what the phrase history is settled means. You're quite right. It's commonly said that each generation reaches back into history and draws its own lessons. So in a sense, history is always being rewritten. If that person means that all the great controversies have been settled, that actually to me starts sounding like Frank Fukuyama. It's just as a P.S. to the thing on Fukuyama. He was accused of saying that history had ended. What he was actually saying, and he clarified later, he was essentially saying that all political models had been tested out, and that our model had won out in the realm of ideas. He wasn't actually saying that that history had ended as far as conflict and competition and so on and so forth that had ended. So which actually makes a good comeback to the idea that history is settled. It may be settled right now, but that might be one of those things that's only true until it's not true anymore. This is one of the big debates that we're having as we debate American decline, is to what extent is the international system as it currently exists, is it self-enforcing, or do you actually have to have a big guy on the block in order to enforce it? If the answer is that the United States is going to continue to decline, the U.S. Navy is not going to be able to do what it's done for the last 70 years, namely police the seas in concert with allies. Well, I think that history might be settled right now, but it might become unsettled again very fast. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well,
interesting to hear a historian say that, actually.
Yeah, I know. That's why it kind of set me back. I'm like,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
And especially somebody at Harvard who's going to be inculcating that into impressionable minds who, 5, 10, 15 years down the road are going to be probably in pretty important positions. And that worries me because that leads to strategic shock and strategic surprise down the road, which never ends well.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Nicholas Taleb's the Nicodemus Taleb's books, and particularly The Black Swan, which is essentially an answer to that sort of thinking. But that Taleb basically says we're hardwired for linear thinking, but oops, you know, once in a while, September 11th or something like that comes along, and then we have to figure out what to do. So you got to be aware of black swans.
Well, but if you're a tenured professor at Harvard and you've already written your book, I would think you'd look forward to an opportunity to issue a second edition and make more revenue that way. But Harvard professors.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, well, I mean, one thing you see with academics and is that if you put it out there and you have a thesis, if you have your particular big idea that you've been pushing and then circumstances move on, the tendency is to try to insist that your thesis is still valid even if circumstances have rendered it moot or it needs to be it's not an easy thing to say you're wrong or to go back and revise what you've said in the past.
Eagle One?
Yeah, I'm here. It looks like
Jerry Hendricks. Oh, no, I thought he dropped out. Okay.
No, I'm still here. If you want to pick up on Jerry Hendricks, he's on the phone apparently, so I'll defer to him.
Okay, Jerry, you on the board?
Yeah, I'm here. I wanted to clarify the nature of the conversation, and so because I'm kind of interested what Dr. Holmes would have to say is I approached them because the chair, maritime history chair, that was occupied, in fact, was endowed for Samuel Eliot Morison is currently occupied by an Indian scholar who studies internal Indian politics. And so when I approached them in an effort to say, hey, why aren't we studying maritime history? Why aren't we studying naval history at Harvard? In this chair, that was occupied by Morison, they said, well, you know, maritime history is settled. There's nothing really new that's happened. There's no major, strategic events. International trade, international norms are settled. No large changes in the last 70 to 50 years or so, and so there just wasn't any interest in taking that chair when the current occupant vacates it and bringing it back, which is what I was lobbying for at the time. So that seems to be the thesis that they're operating from, and my point to them was that given the Arctic and South China Sea, that I think history is about to show up again. And that they need to get ahead of that. And quite frankly, I'm doing an outreach now to a number of different colleges that used to study maritime history and are no longer doing so in an effort to try and get that those classes being taught again.
Well, Jerry, why don't we have you?
I'm glad you called.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I thought he was talking to me, not to you guys.
Oh, he was. I'm sorry. I jumped in. Please, go ahead.
No. I was just going to – I guess I was going to say two things. Well, first, thanks for calling in. It is kind of, for somebody who's never served in uniform, it is, I mean, if you look back, what was the last big naval battle, Leyte Gulf back in 1944, if big naval battles are what you consider the arbiters of maritime history, and if they never happen again, or if they never happen anymore, I guess you could say that, you could take that view. It's certainly not a view that I would subscribe to. The other thing is, and I think perhaps the more, pernicious effect of that would be, we've heard before that history is settled, and that is, it wasn't just Fukuyama a century ago. We're coming up to the commemorations of World War One. Bear in mind that very very influential people like Norman Angell and David Starr Kaye out at Stanford before the First World One. Before the First World War, argued that economic logic made war moot. It was suicidal, self-defeating, and so on and so forth for nations to go to war simply because they jeopardized their economic interests. So it's and obviously we know that was not true because World War One did happen. So history was settled and then it was unsettled.
Jerry, while I have you on the line here, I think I'd like to just throw a question out to both you and Jim on something you brought up. Back when I was in college, I had an interesting conversation with one of my history professors because at one point I wanted to go along his line of work, and he told me, no, do not come in my line of work, and whatever you do, don't specialize in military history because nobody wants us anymore. And this was back in the 80s. He was already talking about the purging of the type of history that he taught. And interesting what you said, how you have a chair that's actually being occupied by somebody who has got not his area of specialty. And so the question I have for you, you know, obviously, Jim, at the Naval War College, you're seeped in that in luxury, but where out there in our top-tier schools would somebody with an interest in military history or maritime history, where would they be able to find at least neutral territory or at least fertile territory, an institution that's interested in studying it from a historical perspective? Now, Jerry, we'll go to you first because you've been pulsing the system here recently. What's out there for somebody like that?
Well, I mean, oddly enough, outside of Ohio, North Carolina, there's not that many schools that are making large investments within their curriculums in either military history or a subspecialty of naval history. And one of the reasons why I was contacting them was, one, you know, I'd done a graduate degree there, and so I have an interest in the school. But beyond that, you know, we're in the process over the next 4 or 5 years of hiring historians of the Naval History and Heritage Command, and I'm looking for viable candidates, you know, who can have a new take on these things. And unfortunately, there's not a large population of schools where we can draw from, so I wanted to begin making some of these schools aware of the hiring opportunities that will be coming in the future.
Yeah, if I can jump in, a few years ago, a poll was taken at the faculty asking us who among the faculty would like to be listed as a maritime historian. And I'm not a historian, strictly speaking. I went ahead and put my name on the list, but the figure that came out was I think there are 130 maritime history historians in all of North America. Jerry probably knows the exact number, but it's a shockingly small number. And he's right. I actually worry about schools like Fletcher, like the Fletcher School, my alma mater, and so forth. It's much the same in international relations. The sort of hard security specialists are surrounded and outgunned, as it were. I think that's a real change. Yeah, I think if you want to study that stuff, I think Ohio State, maybe Southern Miss, places like that still have military history and. As far as maritime history, Jerry probably knows better than I do. But Florida State's the only place that comes to my mind. Right off the bat. East Carolina has a maritime studies, but it's not strictly history. If I wanted to study maritime history, and I'd probably go over to the UK and study with Jeff Till or somebody like that.
Yeah, I find that amazing. The institutions will be the first to complain about. The Department of Defense and national security entities not being able to connect the dots are the same ones that aren't supporting the intellectual effort to create dot connectors. Eagle One.
Yeah, Jerry, you noted in the chat room earlier, you did a presentation, I guess, to Bob Wirt before he left about an Arctic influence squadron. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, just the one off there was, you know, he wanted to know, you know, how I had arrived at a certain number, which was 355 ships we needed in the Navy. And he said, you know, I'd like to see the breakdown. So I gave him the breakdown, and within that was one of the 15 influence squadrons I laid out in there. And force structure was actually comprised of a mothership, icebreaker, not all year round, clearly, but worth a year to hold our interest in the region.
Jerry, you're breaking up a bit here. We're coming up for just about a minute and a half left. Jim, just to come back for you, I had a couple questions for you. One, have you had anybody in the Coast Guard contact you to say what a great article or to throw dark laurels at you? And also, what are you working on next that we can get to look to read from you?
Well, the first question is easy. I haven't heard from anybody in the Coast Guard, so I wasn't sure whether to expect some congratulations or get an irate email or what have you. But pretty much silence at this point. So I would hope to. I like hearing from people out there on the front lines, but hadn't happened yet. The second thing is, well, I mean, I always have something going as far as short pieces and whatnot. My next big thing is. I'm working on a book for the Naval Institute, essentially an analytical history of the U.S. Asiatic fleet. It's kind of a topic that that would warm Jerry's heart because I'm looking at it as an exercise in maritime diplomacy, in naval diplomacy, looking all the way back to Matthew Perry, Commodore Perry steaming across to or sailing across rather to open up Japan. So, but that's a little ways down the road still, probably next year.
Do you take it back from the black ships all the way up to the Battle of Java Sea? What time frame are you looking at?
Yeah, I think I'm going to start with Perry and start with Perry and bring it all the way up to the sinking of the Asiatic fleet. So that's there have been a lot of excellent books about various bits of Asiatic fleet history, but not really anything concentrating on the Asiatic fleet itself. I mean, there was James Hornfisher's wonderful history of the Houston a few years ago, but there really hasn't been a standalone history of it.
Well, hey, sign me up. I'm ready to read that one because that's an area.
Oh, it is fascinating. Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim, for coming in this Sunday. It's been a great hour. As always, and we'll boo on the Coast Guard. They should at least call you up and cuss at you, or if they're not going to be positive about it, because I think both your article about the utility of the Coast Guard in the Arctic, and also maybe they could do some more with the Air Force or some good thought pieces, because this is the time to start thinking about it, not when you need it.
Hey, thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Jim.
Hey, bud.
Hey, and thanks for everybody for joining us today. Next week will be a best of for Easter. Hope everybody continues to enjoy their spring and have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Malone wants to marry me and so leave the strand and